So this is the last organized event for the day, a panel discussion on the subject of the future of venture capital. It's an interest. It's an area that I have some interest in, and I'm sure everybody on the panel does as well. Over time, the venture capital industry has changed, evolved quite a bit. These days, we have big funds, small funds, angels, micro funds, crowdfunding, all kinds of different things going on. And this group of individuals is very well positioned to talk about some of these topics and other things. First, we have Mike Gogan, who received his degree in electrical engineering from Cornell in 1986. Mike has been a managing partner at Sequoia Capital for over 17 years, where he focuses on infrastructure and technology investments. Prior to Sequoia, Mike spent 10 years in various engineering, research, and product management roles at DEC, Synoptics, Centellion, and Bay Networks. Next up is Ed Hurwitz, who earned a degree in molecular biology, graduating in 1985. Ed is currently founder and managing director of Precision BioVentures. Ed was a director of Alta Partners from 2002 to 2013 and continues to serve as a director on investments in technology-driven companies. As a director of Alta Biopharma Management and a consultant to Alta Partners Management. Scott Nolan received both a bachelor's and a master's in mechanical and aerospace engineering from Cornell in 2004. He is a principal at Founders Fund, and he focuses on technology-driven companies. And bear with me one second. Roger Strauch, who graduated in 1978 with me, with a degree in electrical engineering. Roger is the chairman of the Rota Group, a seed-stage venture capital group based in Berkeley, California. His firm, co-founded in 1997 with fellow Cornellian Dan Miller, provides entrepreneurs the resources, environment, and guidance to launch and grow their high-technology businesses. Interesting side point, when I first went to Cornell, I bumped into some engineers around the dorm, and you know how you quickly sort of try to find friends to get grounding? Roger Strauch was my guy when I first arrived there, and we both have the same birthday. Andy Verhalen has earned not one, but three degrees from Cornell, bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering in 78 and 81, and an MBA from Johnson in 81. As a general partner at Matrix Partners, Andy works with several young companies in the area of communications, semiconductors, software, and systems. Finally, we have our moderator and my partner at Kanan Partners, John Balin, who earned his degree in electrical engineering in 1982 and an MBA from Johnson in 1986. As I mentioned, John is a GP at Kanan Partners, where he brings more than 25 years of venture and technology experience to the table, supports ventures in all areas of information technology, including digital media, e-commerce, and fintech. John, take it away.
Thanks, Eric. Well, I'm proud to have such a great panel here. It's amazing how many people come from the venture capital business come from Cornell, and I think it has a lot to do with the way our school operates, and just proud to have everybody here. So kicking things off for our panel, as Eric said, there's a whole, you know, the venture capital industry is subject to the same changes that the companies in which we invest in try to change the industries they're in. And right now there's a lot of buzz about super angels, micro funds, accelerators, and crowdfunding. And we really wonder, how is this changing the landscape for the venture capital industry as it's been set for so many years? So to kick things off, I'm going to talk to my friend Andy. As you define some of these things, how have you reacted as a firm at Matrix to these things, and what do you think about this as you move forward?
Well, generally, it's been a positive trend for us. Their new sources of capital have brought a lot of new investments to the market. A lot of these companies that have been funded by super angels or all the various forms of seed funds might not have been funded by traditional venture sources. A lot of them won't or don't work out, but a few of them do become interesting companies. And often there's a good opportunity for us to step in, help them build a management team and scale the business. And there's still a lot of work to be done there. So we view it as a very positive thing for the industry overall.
That's good. Mike, what's your view?
Well, first, venture capital is like any other business. If you don't change, you die. So we always have to be reacting to changes in the environment, and the advent of the micro angels and the angel community has been a change since I've been there. It really came about, though, in my opinion, based on a whole category of companies that became much more inexpensive to get off the ground. So as technology changed, suddenly you could start a company, whether it's a mobile app or even a web-based company, given all the tools available, the infrastructure available, for very little money. So you could have an angel throw in a few a few hundred thousand dollars and actually get some real results and get the company off the ground. Now, the interesting thing, though, is people tend to confuse cost to start with cost to scale, meaning these companies oftentimes are quite cheap to get off the ground, but if you actually want to then run like crazy, because these have to be fast-moving companies to stay ahead and get the dominant market share and so on, sometimes they become very expensive, which explains why some of these companies were involved in Dropbox, for example, or some of these others, took very little money to get off the ground and get really wonderful momentum,
yep,
but now have raised a ton of money. So, and it's really because once you start to get that critical mass, then you really need to go for world domination.
Roger, how have you seen it in the clean tech space, which you're so fond of?
Well, we're not seeing enough investment in the clean tech space, but we're seeing right now, we're seeing much more interest since we do a lot of physical sciences, new technology development from Asian investors who want to come in, and they see, as we do, climate change issues as clear and present danger to their environments and to their countries. So for the things that we're seed investing, we're now seeing a lot of Asian investor interest.
Yep. Ed, you're our sole life science representative here. How has it affected your business?
It's been small. Healthcare, I do mostly pharmaceutical development. The initial capital intensity of the business doesn't leave enough room for the small micro angel type funds to move a project to a place where there's validity. We spend a lot of time now in academia trying to think about how do we translate some of that science, and the pharmaceutical industry stepped in to a large degree, and just to give you a sense, it's $3 to $5 million for kind of moving a program out of academia until you have some animal experiments that most of the traditional venture community will care about. So we haven't seen it from these traditional sources, but we see it coming from industry sources.
Yep, that sort of makes sense in the pharma business especially. So Scott, from the Founders Fund, how are you working with angel funds and micro funds and so forth?
Yeah, I think going back to the question of is it positive or negative, I think it sounds like everyone views it as like mostly positive. I think that there is this emergence of a type of company that doesn't require much funding to prove product market fit, to kind of get off the ground. And there's a lot of, you know, new funding sources that go along with that. I think as those other funding sources that are in some ways competitive with traditional VC move on to other areas where it's not just purely the really low funding amount types of companies, I think it actually does eat in a little bit to the VC opportunity. It makes it more competitive. So I think, you know, the investors have to adapt or die.
Yep.
So I have a more mixed view on it in terms of how we're working with accelerators and early stage investors. I think in general, our approach is, you know, work with the people that are investing at the earlier stage that invest in the types of companies that we like to back, and build those relationships so that when it is time to scale that business, we're there and able to fund that growth.
Let me jump in there. I agree. I think there's a class of companies for which a well-constructed seed round can actually be a very useful thing for everyone. So for example, in the consumer internet space or sometimes in the SaaS space, a very good seed investor can help them find product market fit, and that removes risk in exactly the area that's hard to judge at the concept stage. And so for those kind of, you know, financings, it makes a lot of sense. In other cases where they seed a company and get it started, but they don't actually reduce the risk in any way or prove
right.
anything, but then they come back and expect a higher valuation, and it's purely a financial vehicle, that can actually be very damaging, because then they go about trying to create an auction for a financing. They don't really allow the founders to get to know the prospective investors very well, or vice versa. And before you know it, they're in business with someone that they don't really know. They don't understand what they can get from them, and vice versa. And I think that's where it can be a very constructive impact on our business. So a well-constructed seed round with seed investors who know what they're doing and are truly helpful to the company and help de-risk it, it can be good for everyone. It's good for the whole industry.
Yeah, I would say just overall, something sounds like everyone's cooperative with these groups. We're all trying to work together. There is some co-opetition, if you will, has always been in the venture business. I think outside of Silicon Valley, you'll find more of the super angels and those kind of groups, and they're less familiar with how the venture industry operates, at least the way the Valley operates. So I think we're all dealing with this funding source as a group, and everyone finds it somewhat advantageous to get companies going and get a little more risk reduction, but like everything else, nothing's identical, and certain groups will tend to fund things in different ways that may not be optimal for the entrepreneur. Moving on, you know, another thing that everyone likes to ask in something like this is, you know, what areas do you find interesting, of interest? And so I'll start with the IT group here, and maybe kicking off with Scott. You know, what are you finding interesting in terms of investment at the moment in the IT space?
Yeah, I think IT is a really broad space. It's like, you know, everything exactly. That's software and some hardware too. So let's see. Yeah, it's pretty broad. So I think stepping back a second, how do we think about IT? I think really it's, you know, why do you want to have information technology? It's so you can do more with information, so you can have more productivity. And the general way we think about human productivity is the full spectrum of, you know, people and making them more effective in their jobs, all the way up to just kind of general artificial intelligence, which would ultimately replace people in some jobs. And then there's this spectrum. So I think we generally cut it into three areas, you know, general AI, and there's a couple of companies we've invested in there. Tools that make people more effective in their jobs, like Palantir, that are, you know, helping people analyze huge amounts of data, because there's this huge kind of big data trend, but the challenge is making information out of that data and actionable information. And then the middle category is probably within specific verticals and specific applications, giving people full software stacks that make them much more productive. So, you know, that translates into like vertical specific, industry specific software packages,
yep.
AI companies, and then just general platforms.
When like you think about AI, is it AI for a consumer application or AI for a business to business application?
Let's see, it could be either. I think in the most, if you're really investing in general AI companies, which there's very few of, I think that the idea is that that can then be applied to any sort of application.
Well, I think what we saw just a minute ago from Google, and I think also what is Apple's espousing, having Siri be sort of your answer person to get everything, everyone is starting to push the envelope on the next level of these things, and we're seeing a lot of it.
Yep.
Mike, what are you seeing at Sequoia?
Across a big chunk of IT, the world has gotten really, really interesting again after being going through periods when there's too much stabilization and it's not so interesting. So specifically, we define infrastructure as everything below the application, so networking, storage, compute. And for a while there, when, let's say, networking had consolidated into the big giant companies that owned the channels, technology wasn't changing that much to really make much of a difference. Same thing with storage, big giant, you know, tens if not $100 billion market cap companies. And in that world, we could occasionally find investments that were sort of interesting, maybe better, cheaper, faster, this widget or that widget, maybe the company would get bought. But that's not really exciting. What's really exciting is when you can build the next wave of the $100 billion market cap companies. And what we've seen in the last 5 years or so is that's starting to happen. And the reason is, a couple of technology changes that are all on sort of exponential curves have hit the interesting part of that exponential curve, the straight up part. So whether it's compute power, with the inverse of that being the cost of compute coming really low, and in particular that one is that, to put it most simply, on a standard server blade from Intel today, with all the right bridges and interfaces and so on, you have enough horsepower so that really good software engineers can emulate what big vendors are selling for $200,000 in let's say a blade or a box. And now you can do that for $6,000 or $5,000. That's huge, right? And then other technologies such as virtualization from companies like VMware that took a long time to mature on the compute side finally became mainstream. So once that happened, everybody said, wait a minute, that was really valuable. I got to consolidate all my compute, get all these efficiencies. Now I want that in storage, now I want that in networking. So there's this whole notion of what we're calling software-defined infrastructure. So commoditized hardware, all the cost is getting squished right out of the hardware, and it's all software. Another way to look at the change or the trend is that companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, they had to innovate this way. Their scale was so huge, they couldn't build their infrastructure the traditional way. The math just didn't work. So instead, they said, we have to think differently. They went to commoditized hardware, and they did it all in software. Well, now the rest of the enterprise world is catching up. and saying, well, we have scale issues too, and we have the cost issues too, we want to do it that way. So it's led to this incredibly interesting wave of new companies that you know we're very heavily involved in, and I'm sure these folks are as well, that I think could be the next kings on the throne.
Yeah, we used to worry a long time ago about the amount of transistors you can get into a chip, and now it's about how much computing power we can get per dollar. It is getting incredibly inexpensive, as we see by the war of Amazon and Google right now as they're changing the cloud thing. Andy, at Matrix, how are you looking at IT right now?
Yeah, I agree. I think the next 20 years we're going to see a lot of change as both ends of the network, you know, at the client side, everyone's moving from PCs to mobile devices, to iPads, to other single-purpose devices. And at the data center side, it's being replaced increasingly by the cloud. And those two things are going to cause a lot of different requirements in all of the infrastructure to connect them together. So we think it's a very interesting time. I agree that the amount of computing power that's available has changed the game at every level of the network. And I think it's not something that's going to be the next few years. I think it's the next 10 or 20 years that there's going to be a continuing evolution of this.
Yeah, as Amit said, Google said it's 15 years and we're just getting started. And I think you can kind of start seeing this tipping point again where there's really another exciting wave coming up because of the inexpensive computing power that we have just so readily available in your hand. Ed, in the life science space, biotech's gone through a little bit of a boom, obviously. Some great companies come flowing through. What's your view as you look ahead and things that you find interesting right now?
Well, it's been a long time coming. Life sciences moves much more slowly than tech, so we look at development timelines of 7 to 15 years on a lot of the projects that we look at. Because of returns, a lot of the capital flow has shifted towards later stage opportunities, and so there's been a crunch on early innovative stuff, and I'd say that's, the contrarian in me says that's the place to look for the next big opportunity. And I think there's a convergence here of some technology developments with informatics and advances in next generation sequencing technologies that are delivering to us an understanding of the genome and how mutations or alterations in that genome predict disease. And we're really at the very forefront. You know, we've heard this tipping point argument. We're really just beginning, and we're maybe 10 years into the genome was sequenced for the first time in the year 2000, and it cost about $1 billion to do that first genome, and here we are 14 years later, and I can do a whole genome just as accurately in about 2 days for about $1,400, $1,500. So that wave of information is now where the best minds and scientists are trying to figure out how do we apply this, understand disease, and then pick targets and new therapeutic modalities that can, with real laser precision, change the outcome. And why that's exciting is that if you have that type of biological insight into a disease and you can modulate that pathway, and we have pretty good tools now that once we know what target we want to interact with in the body, we can design those drugs with pretty, not standard, but it's mechanically very doable with a lot of brute force. You can get to a good drug these days once you know what you want to target. And if you have that kind of precision, the timelines and the development costs that have historically plagued the industry of $1 billion to get a drug to market in 15 years, there's a whole new paradigm where in 25 to 50 patients and $15 million worth of data, you can really begin to transform a disease. So you've heard a lot about orphan diseases, and it's really being led by this genetic understanding. So I think you're going to continue to see a huge wave of investment built around this genetic understanding. And the flip side of that, where it's not a space I know well, but I've been starting to go to some of these meetings, is the digital health area, where this is the consumer now getting access to that information and thinking about how that information can change my daily life. And I think you're just going to see a wave of revolution of what you and your parents that we're all going to take care of are going to carry around and how we're going to be connected to their health and whether their heart rhythms are normal, whether their glucose and their insulin is normal, whether they took their pills that day. So I think there's a huge revolution coming on the digital side where it'll be the direct interface with the consumer.
Yeah, there's no doubt the overlap now with the computing power with the healthcare IT space, as you will, is really starting to get people's imaginations going. So moving on to clean tech, so Roger, I'll come back with you. What are you finding interesting as you're looking ahead now? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but were you finding something?
Well, in clean tech, we're looking for technologies that produce low carbon energy that enable us to use our natural resources much more effectively. And our investment thesis is that global climate change is a clear and present danger that technologies and people can and should address. And what we're seeing are opportunities for in water, for example, where one should remediate bad water and make it good water, or in agriculture, where you can produce a chemical, for example, that could produce or help a higher crop yield with less water. Technologies that take carbon dioxide out of industrial gas flues and separate the carbon dioxide so that it could be used for commercial purposes and sequestered at the same time. A new form of battery that would help us enable the grid storage vision that would enable, once again, solar and wind to be much more valuable to society, so that you could store the energy that they produce and use it later in the day much more cost effectively than we're able to do so today. These kinds of technologies are being developed all over the world. One of the exciting things about our particular investment practice is that you have to go back, as we did as information technologists decades ago, into the labs, in this case the physical science labs, research labs all over the world, and try to find the scientists who've been working on these kinds of technologies and identify the technologies that can be made available and made commercially viable within 5 to 10 years.
Do you see the Governor Brown recently stated just about the changes that are going to be happening with the, we got to come under control better with the changes that are happening in the climate. It's going to affect us greatly. If those of us all live in California know the drought, I think Mountain View today was starting to put rationing back into play. Do you see some of those things coming through some of the investment flow that you're seeing kind of reignited, if you will?
Yeah, for sure. As I mentioned earlier, quite frankly, outside of our country, because we are so rich and have so little day-to-day worry as a country, other countries that have a much larger fraction of their population that are not so well off, their risk of an agriculture crisis, for example, is much greater than ours, or a pollution crisis.
Yep.
They're much more attuned to this near-term issue of addressing it with their issues with investment technology and investment decisions.
Yep.
But yeah, in California, our determination to be a little bit more energy efficient is going to, I hope, bring us more capital and more attention to this area.
Yep. Mike, do you see anything at Sequoia where you're looking at clean tech today versus yesterday?
Well, starting in about 2007, I was, somewhat reluctantly volunteered to be the quarterback for all of our clean tech efforts. And I only use that word reluctant because even then, it wasn't clear to me, it wasn't clear to us, how many companies could be created that could be truly enduring companies. Because the issue is, and it's a line I've used in talks at clean tech forums, not necessarily to the pleasure of everybody, to the zealots in the audience, is the key to sustainability, if you really want to achieve the environmental goals you have, is you have to build a sustainable company. And what that means is you have to build a company that's actually going to survive, and a company that doesn't depend on an infinite stream of cash from somebody to make it survive. And that was the problem, I think, in a lot of the companies that got funded in what they call sort of the clean tech bubble, and popping of that bubble was the demise of a lot of those companies, because they really depend, they weren't good businesses. They could be noble as anything in terms of the science, yeah, but they just didn't make sense in terms of a company that would eventually start generating cash and be profitable and self-sustaining. So so in leading Sequoia's effort, we're fortunate we stayed away from all of those. At one point I made the somewhat facetious comment that we're proud of our record because we lost less than anybody else. But that isn't true. We've actually net positive on our portfolio. And in fact, we have a couple of companies, one called Sunrun now, that's doing very well.
Yep.
More in the solar finance business. And I'm on the board of one called Tula Technologies, which, fabulously interesting, this was applying signal processing technology and algorithm chip guys to the engine control unit of standard gasoline engines, and we have big giant deals with some of the biggest OEMs on the planet because basically with algorithm changes and how they fire cylinders, we get 20-25% fuel efficiency savings. So that company's going to be a winner as well.
Well, what's interesting about that is even like fracking, which is a technology was long ago developed and no one paid attention to it. It does take government work to put pressure on some of these things, both in California. If the CAFE laws right now are changing a lot of cars, you'll see with hybrid power plants as well as turbocharging, which has been around for a while, but it takes government or macro pressures, at least in the United States, to make some of this stuff happen. And you know, we're obviously all aware of Tesla and Elon's work there, and it's caught people's imagination what's possible. And you know, you can definitely see some of this stuff starting to come back around. So it's probably we're only in the probably the first chapter, maybe, if you will, of the clean tech space.
Yep. And one thing Mike mentioned that I don't think people realize is how severe that bubble actually was. So if you take an index of all the clean tech companies and compare it directly to the NASDAQ bubble in 2000, it's actually even worse for some of the plots that I've seen. So it was really severe. And so I think, like you guys, we were famously anti-clean tech for a while, at least anti-clean tech investing around 2007. And now that everything's come down a lot, we've started to get involved. And I think the way that we've thought about getting involved is what has changed. And I think the huge change that killed a lot of companies was the cost of solar panels dropping due to China and their actions on that front. And so, you know, what companies can take advantage of that? So we're investors in SolarCity, which has done quite well, and also some battery companies that can, you know, turn intermittent into baseload.
But on the bright side,
We
invested in a company called Solazyme, which uses algae and sugar to produce oils, oils for fuels, oils for chemicals, oils for cosmetics and food. And the company does not yet sustain itself, but when we invested at less than $10 million value, we sustained our investment through many years, and it's now a public company with a lot of promise, well thought of company that's worth $750 million. And that's not WhatsApp sold for a whole bunch more, but it shows that you can have successful investment opportunities today and take that risk. And we hope that Solazyme becomes a 21st century oil company, sustainable oil.
Well, I think like a lot of things, you know, we are shooting over the horizon in the venture business. That's our job. And people get over, you know, get over exuberant, if you will, in a lot of these different sections. And we've seen it from every industry, you name it. It's been over. There's exuberance, you know, tends to go overboard. But in the end, what comes back is a lot of progress has been made. And you kind of see the next phase of this with more rationality and thoughtfulness in creating the companies. And you know, we'll see more clean tech deals. It just won't be done in the manner in which it was just sort of a floodgates effect, if you will. Moving ahead, you know, as we think about the venture business, and Andy, you've seen this business from, you know, I think classic IT technology. We were building the computer, if you will, to where we are today. What's your view of the challenges in the venture business today from your perspective and having such a great career at Matrix?
You know, I think the biggest challenge for the industry is returns. And I know you see all these big winners, and we've had a lot of them over the years as an industry. But as an asset class, venture capital has never been a good asset class. And that's because the returns are concentrated in a relatively small number of deals in a relatively small number of firms. And by and large, if you were to invest in us as an index fund, you would be a very unhappy investor. And so I think for the industry to scale, we've got to find a way to improve returns overall. And I think some of that comes from discipline among the venture firms and the limited partners and not overfunding and not duplicating so much. You know, when I joined Matrix in the early 90s, if Sequoia funded a company to do a particular product, and some other entrepreneurs came to us and said, well, we want to build that product, we would say, no, they're doing that. Do something more interesting. Do something else. And that was sort of the norm in the industry up to that point. Well, starting in the mid-late 90s, just the opposite started to happen. If we funded a company to build a particular type of product or service, and other firms found out about it, 6 months later, there'd be three more firms trying to do exactly the same thing. And well, competition's good. I'm a big believer in free market. Too much competition, especially in industries like this, which are just getting started, or you know, companies that are just getting started, It just causes a lot more capital to be spent. It causes it to take a lot longer to get a product, a company to be cash flow positive. And it's really, you know, detrimental to the returns in the industry. So I think that's, you know, an ongoing challenge. It'll always be a challenge, yep. But I think it's, for it to scale, it's got to be improved.
Mike, what's your viewpoint?
We're, I think, 42 years old, and Sequoia Capital is, and we've stuck pretty, I guess, religiously to a formula that works. And independent of what cycle you're in, up, down, sideways, and I think that's one of the important lessons is the firms have to figure out what the real essence of being successful is, picking the right companies, being disciplined on valuation, for example, being disciplined on the type of entrepreneurs they want to be in business with, being disciplined on what their firm is all about. One side note is that I've observed anyway, and it's been commonly noted, that one of the most difficult things in the world of venture capital is to actually build a sustainable firm. And the reason why there aren't very many sustainable firms, meaning firms that have been around for a long time and have had spectacular results consistently for decades and decades, is that there's a whole bunch of human behavior involved. So for example, a couple of smart folks get together, they form a venture capital firm, and heaven forbid, they're successful in a couple of investments. Well, then they've just made a lot of money, personally, right? Sometimes a real lot of money. And oftentimes they say, that was fun, this is fantastic, now I'm gonna go ski for the rest of my life, so the firm blows up. Or somebody started the firm and maybe they made a brilliant investment at the beginning when they started the firm and their name's on the door. And after that initial success, they try to sustain the firm for years and years, but they've actually lost the edge. Their name's still on the door and they still, let's say, own all the economics. But so the firm's around for a long time, but it's the walking dead because they're hiring young, energetic folks who pretty soon get disillusioned that they're never gonna, this glass ceiling and so on, and that founder is playing golf all day. And you know, what am I doing working so hard? So there's all these human dynamics that make it hard to make a firm sustainable. So I think the essence of, you know, having more firms that are sort of iconic firms are to have the folks that get a formula that works, understand it's all about a firm being sustainable, not just individuals.
Yep. You know, the industry is kind of, in many ways, a small business still. Yeah. You know, as big as the firms are, the amount of money people manage, most of the firms are not that large, in relatively speaking. And it's a little different dynamics than we have in building a Google or a big company. We still tend to be very small investment firms, even compared to Wall Street or whatever. And I think the press loses sight of that a little bit as they get into the valley and all the hype that goes on around these great winners. The time and effort and the, you know, kind of the craftsmanship of the business is still an important element, and it's hard to duplicate. I think it's just something we all struggle with. Roger, you've been around this as well a long time and seen a lot of firms, and you guys started the Rota Group. What's your viewpoint?
The character of our investing is a little bit different than my colleagues at the table, except for perhaps one, where our investment capital is between one-third and one-half of all of our investments is our personal money. And I think that there's a space for people who are managing limited partners' money, and I think there's also a space for people who are managing their own money. Yep. And there, I agree with what my colleague said. Investment discipline is terribly important, and also a communication with the entrepreneurial community about what, as you heard. Mike quite eloquently characterized some of the characteristics of a promising investment opportunity. And we need to be very open about what we're looking for and very disciplined to stick with that, not just follow what is the latest trend. Investing, I think, one's own personal capital offers an added dimension to discipline. Yeah. And then having a vision of the future, where the world should go, might go, could go, to the investment approach might also help.
Scott, you're from the youngest firms here. How have you looked at it as a firm in this area?
Let's see. So specifically the challenge of VC and how we do things our own way, I think the main cut that we've had, and I think, is that we want to be backing the types of companies that can move human civilization forward in important non-incremental ways, especially where no one else is investing. So I guess the way we thought about this is just do what no one else is doing. Look at the spaces no one else is looking at. Try and invest in places where we have no competition for investing, or at least minimal competition, or where we have some special edge, from a knowledge or network standpoint on that company, that investment. So
that's good.
I think we've really thought about the transformational technology space a lot, combined with where no one else is looking. So.
No, that's refreshing. It's like a lot of firms started that way. So it's interesting. It's good to hear you guys.
And I think one thing we have in common is that most of the money is, or a lot of the money is money from our partners. So
yep.
I think that helps create that discipline around, you know, this is our money we're investing. We're not just trying to run a business here. We really want to make every investment count. And you kind of see the dollars going out of your pocket every time you make an investment. So.
Yep.
It kind of sharpens the mind.
No, absolutely. I was talking to someone the other day. They've started a firm very recently, and that was exactly the discussion, is how do I get my partners to be involved? And I said, well, they got to put money at risk, because ultimately that's what you have to do in this business. And it's easy to pick different names or different stocks, as somebody was saying. It's another thing writing a check. And when you do that, it makes things very crystal clear about what you're doing. Switching gears a little bit, Ed, what do you think of the areas that are underfunded at this juncture? And you talked a little bit about where you're focusing in the life sciences space, but is there something that you think is getting underfunded today that we'll look back and say, oh boy, we should have put more money here?
Well, I think I might have answered some of this previously, so maybe I'll just give you a little more deeper insight into a couple places that today are very exciting and where I think you're going to see a wave of developments. And the first, I guess, is in oncology, where we have really begun to understand why is it that when you get a tumor, your immune system is unable to clear that infection or that abnormal cell, when you get an infection from a bacteria or a virus, the body's pretty good about doing that. And we've unraveled a lot of that immunology, and there are some really exciting major new drugs coming out of the industry that are going to really transform how we treat cancer. And I think we're about probably 12 months away from the first approvals of some of those products and the follow-on prospects of how you're going to combine those agents with other agents that modulate the immune system. I think we're really at the beginning of a very exciting kind of breakout phase in that part of understanding medicine. And the counterpart to that is obviously if we can figure out how to treat cancer, and because you can tolerate toxicity a little more in that setting, we're also unlocking the basic biology of immunology. And so there's a huge world of unmet need out there where people suffer from autoimmune diseases, where we have very, very poor treatments today. And I think commensurate with this biological understanding, there's going to be tremendous opportunity. I would say one other, and we've invested in several of those, and very exciting to see where that stuff's going. And I'd say the other place that's very hot today, and where I think there's plenty of room to keep moving, I mentioned on the genetic side of things, the first gene therapy product got approved in Europe about 18 months ago. And this is a product that you give the injection once and the patient's disease is cured for the rest of its life. And it's kind of the dream of what people in the life sciences industry think about is, can we really correct and cure disease as opposed to just treat it symptomatically? I just had a company go public last week that's taking gene therapy applications into the eye, and the eye is a protected environment, so it's easier to avoid toxicity there. And we're going to take patients, we genuinely believe, over the next 2 to 3 years and restore vision where they're blind and incapacitated. And so I think this wave of this dream of we now have the set of tools, and it's taken 20, 25 years for all the pieces to come together, but I think we're at the wave of this next revolution of these genetic medicines, and it's going to captivate people. It started to captivate Wall Street. Mm. We've had the life science has been the best performing public market sector for the last 2 years, and it's because we're curing diseases finally with either thoughtful medicines or this next wave of things are coming. So I think that I would just say that those same themes of following the basic sciences, and I think back to my genetics course at Cornell, and I had to sort through those fruit flies and figure out which genes were going where. It's really a simplification, but it's taken a very long time, but we are really there now, and I think you're going to really start to see some very visible examples of that, and I think those areas will continue to get all the funding.
You think the feedback loop is now rising, where you're going to get more people starting to follow us? Because healthcare, unlike IT, IT, as Andy said, hey, you can take a company, I'll look around, let's go build one of those. You know, we might be a little bit behind, but we'll play catch up. In the biotech and healthcare space, the feedback loops are much longer for success or failure. And do you think right now we're sort of getting at a point in which we can condense that, at least that's more knowledgeable across, you know, the disciplines?
It's certainly faster, and I think an adjunct to that is that because of the nature of how we're treating smaller populations of patients much more effectively, so the impetus for competition is less. So it's actually turning out that if being first is really perhaps amongst the most important attributes of funding a company here. And so I actually think there's less of that happening, and there's going to be more exclusivity just by the nature of what the technology is taking us down. So if you go into a genetic disease, you really want to be first, and that's why I say you go back to the university where this sequence data is coming together and people are really figuring out the connectivity between the genome and the disease, and you're going to fund companies, and you're going to get intellectual property around that that's going to turn out to be exclusionary and very valuable, is my view of the world. So I think it's going to be a less competitive world for us, but many, many, many more therapeutic opportunities. So it'll develop much more broadly, and we'll have less repetition of people going after the same old thing, or as someone said earlier, incremental improvement.
It sounds like we're just getting started in biotech. Moving on to the entrepreneurs, I'm sure some of you out there are thinking about starting something, so we'd be remiss not to at least talk about this. What, Scott, I'll start out with you and the Founders Fund, since you're right, it's sort of you're focusing on this a lot. What financial strategy do you recommend entrepreneurs to do to fundraise? Is it angels going to see you? What have you been telling some of the entrepreneurs you're working with today?
Yes, so I think it's always case by case. If you think of the spectrum of types of companies, I think on the one end of the spectrum, there's companies that require almost no initial investment, are immediately profitable, and have limited possible opportunities. So, in high school, I had a lawn mowing company, right? So it's like basically labor. I just need a lawnmower. I could borrow that. Gasoline. Didn't really need to raise money. On the other end of the spectrum, you have like Facebook, where it's like, okay, probably not going to be profitable right away. There's some huge value in pouring money in and being the social network that wins. And so I think the question partially is, where are you on that spectrum? And I think if you're more close to the first end, then bootstrapping probably makes a lot of sense if you think you can prove something out and just scale like that. I know GoPro was mostly bootstrapped.
Right.
I think if you have something that in 3 months as part of an accelerator with 20 grand, you can prove something meaningful and get to a big, an inflection point or like proof point with the business, that makes sense. And then I think if you have something that's going to require a long investment period and hard work, like SpaceX, where I used to work, yep, then that one you need to go raise money so that you can.
What have you found in the last year so far? Of you looking at the younger companies, what are they tending to do more recently to get started, at least at the deals that you guys have invested in?
Yeah, I think most of the really young companies do something like using friends and family money or their own money. They'll take some time, they'll get a few people together, they'll build something basic that demonstrates some product market fit. Maybe in parallel with that, they'll be in some accelerator program like Y Combinator. And then usually after that, they'll raise a $1 to $2 million seed round from angels that are, yep, value add. And then from there, once you've proven that out, then you raise an A from VCs and maybe some angels also. So I think that's the basic formula of what we've been seeing.
Yep. Mike?
Well, several folks have mentioned proof points or milestones. I think that's a critical analysis for a founder to do in their company, whatever the business is, to figure out what are the next points in my timeline here where I'll actually prove something, prove my model works, prove my prototype works, prove my new technical innovation does what I think it's going to do or whatever. And from there, you can derive money that you need to get to those next proof points. I'm of the belief that the folks who have started companies and funded themselves sort of frugally with that proof point in mind tend to do better in the long run. The converse of that is, and the sort of danger to watch out for, in this world, sometime when things get a little frothy and there's a lot of money around, you'll see the folks raising, at, let's say, a seed level, a lot of money. You know, I just did a $5 million seed or a $10 million seed or a $20 million Series A. And they're patting themselves on the back, thinking they did a good job. But I have a sense, I haven't seen all the data, but I wouldn't be shocked at all if the data didn't indicate that there's a much lower probability of success for those companies that have overfunded early, just because it says a bunch about the founders first. It says loss of focus, lots of razor sharp logic. So it does depend on the company type. Some of these can get, so let's take the internet ones for a second, since there's so much attention on those, the consumer internet companies. The good news about those companies these days is there's tons of data to analyze. There's a lot of tools and so on to figure out if you're trying to launch something that consumers are using, is it really working? You can do cohort analysis, all that kind of stuff. So it isn't just who downloaded it, but who downloaded it and stayed, whose minutes are increasing, as I added features and so on. So the point is, fairly early in a company's life, with sometimes not a lot of money, right, you can get to that point where the data is all working. And that's maybe when you raise some decent pile of money and start stepping on the gas.
Yeah, I think it's a hard time when things get overfunded. It gets a little crazy out there, right? And people are taking more money than they should take in many of these cases. We have 2 minutes left before our Q&A period, and I thought it'd be nice for everybody to quickly go down the line. What do you look for in an entrepreneur in 30 seconds? And let me start with Andy, because he hasn't spoken in a while.
Well, I'd say there are some basic things you always look for in somebody you're going to invest in, right? Integrity, work ethic. They have to be somebody who really believes that they can accomplish whatever they set out to accomplish through sheer force of will. I look for a bold vision, somebody who really can paint a picture of what they want to accomplish. I'm also very keen on what their incentives are. If somebody's out just to make money, they're not the best guys to back. You really want someone who's trying to build a real company, a lasting company, and is willing to do everything it takes to get there. At least those are some of the high-level qualities.
Roger, anything to add?
Someone who's not very interested in sleep. someone who has a great passion for bringing their product and idea to market. Someone who can balance having a strong personal backbone, a determination to follow a certain path, a path that he or she feels will lead to success for the product and their team and their investors, but also somebody who's a good listener, somebody who's curious, somebody who wants to learn so much more and wants to learn from the people around them and from the experiences that they're having in the course of bringing their product or service to market.
Scott, anything to add?
A lot of the same stuff. I think the main thing for us is we want to back entrepreneurs that have a really clear mission and vision of what they want to do in the world, and not where they're just doing a startup to make money or because they want to do a startup, but because the startup is the only way in the world that they can fully execute that mission. And so that combined with determinism, being coachable yet not really worrying about what other people think too much.
Yep.
I think one phrase I've heard is type A, non-needy, is usually a good formula. And people that are really focused on having a realistic view of what the world is and how they're going to operate in it, rather than just having this idea that they're going to do it this way or no other way. They're constantly updating that and trying to learn as much as they can about what they're doing.
Good. Sorry, go down. Ed, anything to add?
I guess I'd say a really high IQ and enough of an EQ to deal with all the people issues. So everybody said it all. But you know these people when you see them. You sit in a room, you ask a question, and they give you an answer, and then they tell you the answer to five other things that you haven't asked yet, and the light bulbs go on. And you just know that this person is like just so engaged in what they're doing and that they have such ownership of their subject matter that they kind of draw you in and you want to be part of that experiment or part of that program. And I think we all see that after you see enough of it, you kind of feel it and you can tell in 15, 20 minutes whether the guy's a keeper and you really spend time on it or not. So it's a protoplasm thing, and I think it's a skill you develop when you see a lot of people.
Mike?
Sharp, passionate, driven, frugal, obsessed with making an impact. We call these people the dent makers. Steve Jobs was quoted as saying he wanted to make a dent in the universe. So we look for the entrepreneurs who want to make their own dent.
That's really good. That's when you go back to how you build the culture of a firm. There's a little bit of this DNA of knowing when you see it, and when you see it, it's pretty obvious, right, in many cases, which is great. So I think I don't see, We don't have a Q&A period yet, so I'll continue. If you have questions, please text them as what we've been doing normally. Oh, here we go. All right, now we're on. So this is a good one, the first one. I see that there are no women on the panel. Can you talk about the opportunities for women in venture capital? I think that's good.
Well, there are venture capital, female venture capitalists in the audience. Some of them are good friends. There ought to be as many women in venture capital investing as there are men. And we need to, what we are seeing, of course, is that we're seeing many more female executives in information technology and in American business in general, and more female leadership of major universities. And I think it's hopefully just a matter of a few years before we see some of those same people and the role models that they are presenting to encourage people to join the many women, many more women that we will have as venture capitalists.
Andy?
I agree with that. I think, Roger, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in class of 78 EE, there were 3 women and like 141 men. And so, you know, and that was true in our era of yep. technology. There just weren't enough women in technology in those days. That's changing rapidly. At Cornell now, I believe it's, is it a third women in engineering?
It's over 44% right now
so
in the engineering
it's
school.
It's come a long way in a relatively short amount of time, and I think it needs to keep going. But there's definitely a clear need for more women in technology, more women in leadership positions in companies, and that's where most venture capitalists come from, is from startups, from founders of startups, or from leaders in fast-growing high-tech companies.
Yeah, I think
for our kind of investing.
Yeah, Cornell's a leader in this, by the way, in the engineering school. I mean, the national average for women in engineering disciplines is 18 to 19% nationwide. And in Cornell, it's well over, I think it's like 44%. The one thing that is surprising, though, is post-undergrad, graduate studies, it drops again heavily. So if you're a woman in technology, you're heavily recruited, obviously, to get into the work world quickly. And this is still a continued effort. The STEM effort we see here in the Valley right now of pushing having women in venture capital. Our firm has 2 women GPs, and we've funded probably in the last year and a half over 8 to 10 women-founded CEOs. So we're starting to see a sea change happening, and Sheryl Sandberg is in there with the lean-in work, but I think everyone's starting to get more empowered, and we're starting to see another generation of leaders, I think, in the space, and you'll see it more in venture capital. There's another question here, which I think is interesting. This is the Cornell event. What is our view of the venture opportunity in companies in changing higher education? Who wants to take that? Anybody in an ed tech company? Scott, do you guys have one?
Yeah, we have one. Okay. It's called Newton, so it's an adaptive learning engine. And what it does is it takes content from publishers, in higher education and in high schools and working its way down, and takes content and kind of creates a knowledge graph around that, puts AI to work on that, and really helps each student's learning path be as efficient as possible for them. That's one way that it can make higher education maybe more efficient, probably yep. empower some of the online platforms. I think the question is really, what are the opportunities? I think, I think one opportunity is distribution of content, so that would be like the MOOCs.
Right.
And then there's something about making that content much more effective, which is adaptive learning, and I think there's probably a bunch of other things out there, like, teacher tools and things like that. The question that we always have is, why is this a business that no one else can build, or in what way is this a natural monopoly sort of business? So that's what we have to believe to make an investment.
Mike, do you have anything?
I feel like the questioner was probably probing the more controversial aspect of it all, which is how are higher education universities like Cornell and Stanford reacting to some of these technology companies? There's several out there that essentially are trying to commoditize what these esteemed establishments present to their constituents and students and charge the parents. And that's an interesting question, because if you think about it, You know, I've often thought about this. We look at a lot of these kind of companies, by the way, have, you know, on a weekly basis, probably have one or two in, because we do think there's a big opportunity here for disruption. If you think about it, if you scan across all the top universities in the country, there's probably a professor or two who teaches, I don't know, an advanced calculus class the best, you know, in such a way that's so compelling and it engages the students and gets them incredibly, you know, intuitively to understand the subject matter and so on. So if that's the case, why couldn't, with all the technologies we have, we capture that experience and get it distributed in a more, you know, a democratic, right, democratic way, and accessible way. And so there's companies trying to do those kinds of things, and it's really interesting to watch the reactions of the various universities. Some actually are jumping on it and embracing it, saying, look, yeah, it's a change, it's gonna happen, let's get ahead of it, which is, I personally think, the right way to react. And others are sort of, you know, resisting.
Well, it's interesting, at Stanford a week ago, Sal Khan spoke, and they've got now 10 million users, or viewers, have done things, and he had the episode of a student who did not get through freshman year of high school, dropped out twice, and, you know, had to play a bunch of catch up, and eventually got use Khan Academy to get himself back on board, and he ended up, you know, catching up in calculus and math, and he took a test and ended up having the highest grade. Well, long story short, he graduated valedictorian of his class. He went on to Princeton engineering, and he came back and said, you know, without that kind of experience available to him on his computer, he may have just floundered and never got into it. And he said he didn't realize how, you know, how cool it was. So I suspect we're augmenting all these things as we're all seeing these deals. The hardest part in the venture business is, how do we have to monetize these companies. And so I think it's been, you know, people have been walking into it through the years. There's a number of deals, I think, in everybody's portfolios, and it's been one in which we've been gingerly trying to participate in an obvious change, but it's one in which you still have to have a sustainable company to do these things. We've got about a minute left, and I see a question here that says, a lot of the tech industry is full of monopoly at economics, Google for search, Facebook for social, eBay for, you might say, as well as there. Why do VCs shy away from startups? I'm not sure. I don't think we are shying away from startups in any which way, but I think the answer to that, and I don't know if anyone wants to take that, but yeah, we're looking for the next Googles or Facebooks, and I suspect they're still out there. So there's a lot of things you say no to, Scott.
I would guess that the question might have been clipped, and if I had to complete it, I would probably say, why do VCs shy away from funding startups without those monopoly economics?
Right.
I think the way we think about this is that if you actually value a company in terms of discounted cash flow, which is probably the most fundamental way you can do it, and you apply a reasonable discount rate, oftentimes for startups, the growth rate is actually higher than the discount rate, which implies that most of the value sits far out in the future. And so to believe that this is going to be a highly profitable company, highly valuable one, in an industry where your top investment is worth more than like all the others put together, then you've really got to believe that you can last that 10 or 20 years. And so you have to have really deep barriers to entry. You have to have sort of natural monopoly economics. And that's why at least we really focus on the companies that can have that.
That's great. Well, we are right near the end of our session here, and we're the last thing between you and some dinner and drinks. And I'm now turning it over to my colleague, Eric.
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks, panel members. That was tremendous. Appreciate it. So I'm now the last thing standing between you and food and drink downstairs. I just had a couple of quick wrap-up comments, and then we have one traditional obligation that we need to fulfill before we're allowed to leave. First of all, I think we should give a big round of applause for all of our speakers today, over 20 individuals. Next, I'd like to call out a few folks in specific terms who helped make all this possible. And I don't know about you, but I was very impressed with how well organized and how well run this event was. First of all, the Computer History Museum, which allows us to use the facility. Katie Clapp and Katie Lindberg from Cornell Events Management. Amanda Christofferson and Amanda Massa from the Cornell Entrepreneur Network. And lastly, the person who couldn't be here today because she's home with her newborn child, Ashley Binter, the director of Cornell Silicon Valley. One last word of thanks, and that's to all of you. You know, this effort here in Silicon Valley has grown dramatically over the years. You know, I called out Shannon earlier. Ashley's been, you know, following in his shoes, really serving as a stir-the-pot, precipitator, activist, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, we have record attendance today for a reason, and that is because all of you have figured out that it's important to be a part of this network. You're getting value from knowing each other, and showing up at a day like today is more than just hearing about what's going on campus. So thank you for showing up. Continue to show that interest in the university, and it'll pay dividends down the road. Absolutely. Now, I would like to invite John Kaplan, class of 73 and MBA 74, and any members of the chorus or glee club which are here to serve in a role that I'm totally incapable of serving, which is to lead us in the alma mater.
As fellow Glee Club and chorus alumni come up, if there are any in the audience, I will just share with you the fact that as we are devoted to innovation, Cornell in itself is an innovative university, the pioneer of the any student, any study. And in fact, Cornell modeled the idea of listening to customers for the creation of the alma mater. It was the students in the first graduating class that decided that they would compose the alma mater. And in the course of doing so, they rejected the tradition of the time, which was to borrow from church hymnals, national anthems, military songs, and so forth. And instead, they picked a folklore tune, Annie Lyle, which it was, in effect, they borrowed from pop culture and created the tune of the alma mater, which has been adopted by 200 colleges and universities around the country. So with that, we'll start. Far above Cayuga's waters, with its waves of blue, stands our noble alma mater, glorious to view. Lift the chorus, speed it onward, loud her praises tell. Hail to thee, our alma mater. Hail, oh hail, Cornell. Far above the busy humming of the bustling town, reared against the arch of heaven, looks she proudly down.
Thank you.